Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare administration and policy at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, hoping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, it's our monthly medical roundtable. Then, our experts answer your questions. But first, here are a few topics we're covering today from the latest health headlines. Nurses face a rising tide of workplace violence with reported assaults hitting an all-time high. There are continued concerns regarding syphilis in babies and a case of avian bird flu in a human. Additionally, a mysterious post-COVID syndrome, POTS, is affecting young athletes, while shortages plague Eli Lilly's weight loss drug, Zepbound. Joining us to talk about these are our A-team of doctors. We have Dr. Sarah Bowden. She is a board-certified anesthesiologist and a board-certified physician in obesity medicine. Dr. Bowden, welcome as always.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back, and happy to chat with you again.
We are excited to have you here. We have Dr. Dacre Knight. He is a practicing internist. He also directs the Ehlers-Danlos Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Knight, welcome back as always.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
It's great to have you. And last but not least, Chad Nielsen, somewhat of a regular on our program. He is now Director of Infection Prevention and Control for the Nemours Children's Health here in Florida. Chad, always good to have you.
Thanks. It's always a joy to be on the show.
So let's get right on to it. And we're going to take advantage of having you on board here, Chad, in terms of infectious diseases. And we're going to start with the CDC warnings on various infections. The CDC issued a few warnings, including one for meningococcal infections on the rise, a rise in tuberculosis cases, the highest in a decade, and of course, the bird flu case in a human, with just recently released headlines that they have now detected traces of the virus, the avian bird flu virus, in grocery store milk. Chad, I'm going to ask you to break all of this down for us. Let's start with the meningococcal disease. What is it? What should we know about it?
Yeah, so meningococcal disease is a rare bacterial infection that typically causes inflammation of the brain and spinal cord membranes, which is meningitis, or it can cause a severe blood infection, which in our terminology, sepsis. It's typically caused by the bacteria Neisseria meningitidis, and it's extremely serious. It causes death in about 1 in 7 people who are infected. It's typically transmitted through droplets, and outbreaks have traditionally occurred in college dormitories where close contact is present between lots of people from different areas. It is a vaccine-preventable disease here in the U.S., and it can be treated effectively if diagnosed early in the disease course. But that's where we see fatalities, is that it goes untreated for some amount of time.
Let's go to the next bug, tuberculosis. They made a statement about the highest numbers. Tell us a little bit about, or remind us a little bit about tuberculosis, which has been around for a very long time.
Yeah, so tuberculosis is an airborne respiratory disease caused by Mycobacterium tuberculosis is the organism. It's actually found globally, and as you said, it's a very old disease. It's been around a human population for a long time. Last year alone, the most recent data reportable year, the U.S. had 10.6 million active cases of TB, and there were about 535 cases active in Florida. So TB doesn't spread easily, and it typically only spreads among households or close contacts of known active cases. And in most patients, it is treatable with common antibiotics, but we are unfortunately starting to see some resistance in the community. Cases are probably on the rise as resources used by a lot of health authorities to identify, track, and treat it were sort of shunted and sent towards COVID efforts over the last several years. So we think a lot of people now are starting to show up with their signs and symptoms of TB that otherwise might have slipped through the cracks during the pandemic.
Let me go to the last but the most recent one. That has to do with the one human case of bird flu in Texas, I believe. But even bigger story, at least it came off as an alert from the Washington Post just yesterday, prior to this taping, traces of the virus found in grocery store milks that had been tested. What's the significance when we're talking one human case and the testing in milk on grocery store shelves?
Yeah, so bird flu, or what most people in my field call highly pathogenic avian influenza, the scary word, is a virus that epidemiologists and global health officials watch carefully continuously due to its potential for causing a global pandemic. Although most cases in humans are rare and typically mild, as was the one recently found here in the United States, some of the strains of bird flu are more transmissible among humans, and some of these strains actually can infect a variety of different animals. The biggest development in the last couple of years was bird flu jumping from poultry farms and into cows and livestock, as well as its impact on other species. For instance, sea lions down in South America were dying off by the tens of thousands from bird flu, which they've never seen before. And as you pointed out, just over the last several days, the FDA announced that for the first time, they found inactivated bird flu in pasteurized milk from a grocery store shelf. And so, frankly, that's pretty alarming. And it indicates that the spread of bird flu in cows in the U.S. is likely much wider than we've previously known, or that's been communicated to us. The FDA stresses that the milk supply in the U.S. is still safe, but that further testing is ramping up to see how widespread that problem is. But these are all warning signs that bird flu isn't going away, and we should start preparing strategically for, you know, what could be the next pandemic.
Last point, Chad, what should we be doing on a preventative front? If anything, stop buying the milk, go to a plant-based milk, mask up. Any suggestions for those from these different bugs out there?
Yeah, so the FDA is stressing that the milk supply in the U.S. is safe right now. So I don't think we should stop drinking milk or, you know, ditching our coffee creamers for something, you know, plant-based if you're not into that. But I do think on a more global scale, we need to start really putting those actions into place to prevent the next sort of pandemic. Currently, the World Health Organization is racing their own internal deadline to basically strike a global pandemic agreement that involves nearly 200 countries. And that agreement that World Health is trying to put together basically would put in place data, vaccine, and medical knowledge sharing structures to ensure countries are better able to prepare and react when the next pandemic occurs. And so we need to keep pouring money into the public infrastructure to make sure that if bird flu does become something that is more than just, you know, a finding that we see every once in a while with no harm, we'll be better prepared to do this. But right now, I think everybody in the U.S. can continue to carry on their normal activities. And if you can, you know, support your public health infrastructure.
Got it. We're going to pivot to a different topic. Dr. Bowden, we're going to go to you on this. This is the topic of violence against healthcare workers. There's a growing proportion of nurses that say incidents of violence and aggression they face on the job have become routine, and as a result, they are considering an exit from the profession altogether. reported assaults against nurses were up 5% last year, according to an April 2nd Press Ganey report on safety culture in healthcare. By far, the events occurred mostly in psychiatric units, followed by the emergency department, adult and pediatric ERs, and lastly, perioperative units. In recent months, calls from the healthcare workers for federal action to be taken on workplace violence have intensified, with the American Nurses Association, the American College of Emergency Physicians, and Emergency Nurses Association urging lawmakers to pass two bills aimed at strengthening safety protection for workers in the industry. Dr. Bowden, have you seen or experienced this workplace violence that is out there?
Right now, being an anesthesiologist and working primarily in perioperative areas, pre-op and operating room and procedural areas, we're a little bit more protected, as the survey mentions that it's less likely to happen in the perioperative units. But I certainly hear about it quite a bit, and I have experienced a couple of episodes over the course of my career. Fortunately, nothing of great damage to me. I've observed other colleagues who have experienced it, and we certainly hear lots of chatter about it, especially among the emergency room, the healthcare staff, physicians, and nurses both. So yes, it is definitely out there.
Now, I mentioned nurses a lot. Are physicians in this group too? What about violence against physicians as well?
Sure, absolutely. Physicians are definitely vulnerable to it, although the nurses, I would emphasize, as everyone knows, for the most part, nurses are the first line interactors with patients. They spend the most time with patients, even if physicians are maybe prescribing and directing therapy. The nurses are, for the most part, the ones who are spending more time with patients, so they're the ones more vulnerable. Physicians, I will say, some of the workplace violence that I experienced was from other physicians. Yes. So bad behavior amongst physicians towards nurses, towards other physicians, and possibly towards patients is also an issue. I don't think that's exactly what you're getting at. But when I read the questions and thought about experiencing workplace violence, the first thing that came to mind was some inappropriate scenarios that happened to me when I was a resident in particular.
We will definitely have to talk about that on another show for sure. Dr. Bowden, is there anything our listeners, us, we can do to curb these statistics?
As listeners, that's a really good question. I think the most important thing that can be done from an institutional standpoint is support for a culture of safety where reporting is encouraged. And when there's a report of workplace violence, that is doing something to curb it and change that culture, change the safety infrastructure is taken very seriously, and the victims are supported. That is probably the most important part. So as for the public, being aware of the safety environment, if you're going into a facility, are there cameras? Are there locked doors? Is there security readily available? For instance, in big hospitals, like I know the University of Florida, Jacksonville has a very robust security presence both in the emergency room as well as rounding in the hospital for folks that are identified as safety risks.
Understood. And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, it's our monthly medical roundtable, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X at Jay Servin. Dr. Knight, we're going to turn to the topic of postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, otherwise known as POTS, occurring after COVID. Now, this was first described more than 150 years ago and has proliferated since the COVID pandemic. Before 2020, 1 million to 3 million people suffered from POTS in the United States, and that's an estimate from researchers. Precise numbers are very difficult to come by because the condition has a spectrum of symptoms, and many people they haven't heard of it. Recent studies suggest 2 to 14% of people infected with coronavirus may go on to develop POTS. The syndrome tends to strike suddenly, leaving previously healthy people unable to function with no clear cause. In recent years, doctors have noticed a curious and disproportionate subset of patients, female athletes at peak fitness, which is really unusual. Dr. Knight, can you explain just a little bit more about POTS and its symptoms?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we joked on this show before too. It seems like we'll just never get away from COVID, right?
No,
and
we don't.
And it's good to learn, because even if the pandemic has passed and infections have passed, there are still these residual conditions and things that can happen from it that may go unrecognized. And POTS is one of them that we're learning a lot about. So I'm glad you brought it up. So POTS, P-O-T-S, is just defined as postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. So it's kind of an interesting, it is a syndrome. So it's a collection of symptoms, but it's a mix between cardiac and neurologic systems here. So when we're talking about the neurologic side, we're usually relating to the autonomic nervous system, which I know I don't have to explain to a neurologist what that is, but I know not all the listeners here are neurologists. So when we talk about autonomic nervous system, we're talking about the function of our body that's being controlled. We're not thinking about it. So those are functions, whether it's heart rate variability, you know, breathing rates, even digestion, all those autonomic functions, which is branched to between your sympathetic and parasympathetic, which we might remember from our high school science days, our teachers were describing your fight or flight response, right, versus your rest and digest. And so we know that there is some autonomic dysfunction that's it's related to, but POTS, the T in the POTS is the tachycardia. So as we have autonomic control of our heart rate, we can have autonomic dysfunction where our heart rate is doing something what it shouldn't do. And in this case, a POTS is beating too fast, specifically when patients are in an upright position. So that's, you know, that's a little bit of background on what POTS is, but it is interesting to see how it relates to the post-COVID conditions, which we do see it happen at a higher rate and those who have long COVID.
And so are you seeing this in your post-COVID cases that you see, people you take care of?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think many generalists would see this out there, even if they don't recognize it at first. Because it usually comes in different ways. The symptoms that patients present with and the symptoms associated with this syndrome are not only that increased heart rate. I mean, patients may not observe that if they're sitting upright. They may not know that their heart rate is beating fast unless they got an Apple Watch on or something like that, which can be useful. But the first things they usually report are, you know, significant dizziness and lightheadedness. And then if that's ongoing, and by definition, POTS has to be ongoing for it to be diagnosed for at least 6 months. So if that's ongoing, then you can imagine there's a lot of debilitation that these patients suffer from. So there's a lot of fatigue that develops, you know, physical deconditioning too, which actually makes the condition worse itself. So it gets to be a spiral. So usually patients present with complaints of not only the dizziness, but if it's been going on long enough, the fatigue, deconditioning, exercise intolerance. So that's when patients are presenting with those things, that's what we ask about, you know, their infection history, COVID, but also other comorbidities. Sometimes we do see other conditions go with it, which I also see in my specialty practice, which is hypermobility disorders, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, maybe some mast cell activation too in that picture. Sometimes chronic pain or chronic fatigue. Where those get diagnosed as fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome.
And there are treatments for POTS?
Yeah, nothing FDA approved right now, but yes, sure. There are a lot of things that can be done for it. So we usually start, you know, the lowest and easiest treatments first, just to see if they work, have the least side effects. And there are some mainstays to that. So those being adequate hydration. So really want to encourage patients to get enough fluid in throughout the day, maybe salt supplementation as well. And usually that's best received in a form of just salting foods rather than, you know, some patients have taken salt tablets in the past, but that might be too much salt at once. So, you know, increased salt type of foods, whether that's pretzels or beef jerky or whatever you prefer, whatever your diet it can accommodate. And then maybe some compression clothing, compression devices, compression stockings, and then putting all of those things together, really importantly, is a type of exercise program that patients can tolerate. As I mentioned, they have some exercise intolerance, so that's certainly not something you jump into too much too soon. But for example, recumbent cycling or rowing is good because you're close as you can be to laying flat while exercising. And we see a lot of improvements there because in some ways that increases the muscle tone in lower extremities where it acts as like an internal compression stocking and it has longer duration and of course added health benefits, but we just got to get patients to the point where they're able to do that regularly.
Understood. We're going to pivot to another topic. Chad, I'm going to come back to you on this. This is syphilis. Sadly, I seem to bring this up every time you're on the show. I don't mean to do that. But the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists updated its recommendations, now advising a routine blood screening at the first prenatal visit, followed by universal screenings during the third trimester and again at birth. As you may recall, syphilis rates in the United States have ballooned by 80% from 2018 to 2022. In 2022 alone, there were 3,700 babies born with syphilis. Chad, how bad is this syphilis problem in kids, especially here in Florida?
Yeah, so Florida saw a near doubling in the number of syphilis cases among all ages during that time frame you mentioned. In the last reportable data year of 2022, we saw a 153% rise in syphilis for the congenital cases. So we're having a huge problem here in the state of Florida. In the last reportable year, again, we had 276 babies born with syphilis in Florida. And most of our data, once aggregated up to the United States level, is showing that we actually have about the 14th highest rate of congenital syphilis in the entire United States right here in Florida.
What is done in these screenings?
Yeah, so these screenings is being recommended by ACOG to be done at a more frequent interval and then universal third trimester. It's basically a blood screen.
Okay.
And so this blood screen is basically a blood draw that tests what's called a rapid plasma reagent, an RPR test. And this test is run to look for antibodies of syphilis. If these antibodies are found in the pregnant woman's blood, they send it to a secondary confirmatory test to say, yes, you in fact do have syphilis. And then at that point, they can begin treatment.
I'm going to pivot to yet another topic. We're going to go to the weight loss drug phenomenon. Dr. Bowden, I'm going to point this to you. Despite Eli Lilly's assurances about an ample supply of its new weight loss drug, Zepbound, the company is now facing widespread shortages just months after its approval. A note here, Eli Lilly is a sponsor of this program. While the drug maker is working to resolve the issue, a quick fix is unlikely, it says, with no immediate end to the shortage in sight. Dr. Bowden, remind us, what is Zepbound?
Great question. So as you mentioned, Zepbound was approved back in November 2023 for treatment of obesity. It had already been, its generic name is tirzepatide, and that medication was being used for the treatment of diabetes mellitus type 2 under the brand name of Mounjaro for a couple of years before that. It's a little bit different than the kind of popular weight loss medication that was gaining popularity before that, semaglutide, which is marketed as Wegovy. It's slightly more effective as a result of it working. It has an additional mechanism compared to the primary mechanism of semaglutide, which is a GLP-1 agonist. And tirzepatide adds not only GLP-1 agonism, but it also acts on a receptor called the GIP molecule. They both work in the pancreas to increase insulin response to a glucose or carbohydrate meal when it's eaten. So that helps improve diabetes control. It helps improve hemoglobin A1Cs. But it also works in a couple of other ways that encourage helping weight loss. They improve the feeling, increase the time it takes to empty food from the stomach and intestines, so it makes you feel full for much longer. And it also works in the brain. They both work in the brain to on the pathway that encourages the feeling, decreases appetite. They work through the hypothalamus. And so they're both very effective there. It turns out that the tirzepatide is slightly more effective. And unfortunately, as you mentioned, even though Eli Lilly made that assurance that there was going to be plenty of the medication, it is very, very difficult to find right now. Patients who are prescribed the prescription de novo or a new prescription struggle to find a starting dose. Patients who are already on it and need some of the higher doses, as you take this medication, the dose increases over time. It's almost impossible to find medication, both the Zepbound as well as Wegovy and any of the other related GLP-1 medications. They're very, very hard to find right now around the country.
We're going to take a short break for a moment. We are talking with our A-team of experts for our monthly medical roundtable, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. It's our monthly medical roundtable. We're talking to Dr. Bowden at the moment. And Dr. Bowden, I'm curious, if a patient finds themselves in the shortage of Zepbound, let's say they've had it prescribed, they started it. I mean, what do you do in these weight loss drugs if you just can't get your hands on it, even though it's been started with you? Any suggestions of how someone should manage that?
Well, that's happening. That's happening around the country right now. People are having trouble finding the right dosages. Some of the strategies people are using is to space out doses of the medication rather than taking it weekly, taking it maybe every other week or every 10 days or something like that to stretch out doses as they find them. They may be cutting back on doses and using the smaller dose medications if they can find that. Some people are coming off the medications, which is really not the way they need to be used. These drugs need to be maintained, and people with significant obesity may need to stay on these medications for life. We know that. They may not. Not everyone may have to, but most people probably need to take this for life. So this shortage is a real problem. Ideally, if patients are working with a physician or a prescriber who is very familiar with good weight loss practices, they can help them find other alternatives. And that's what a lot of physicians are doing, is using some of the other FDA approved medications or some of the other medications that can be used off label to help with appetite while we're tiding over, hoping that this shortage will ease in the third quarter of the year. But nobody really knows. So it's taking some creativity. My main advice would be to make sure that you're working with a physician who is well-versed in how to use anti-obesity medications and to help you creatively find a solution to these shortages, and to really, really focus on the other pillars of safe, effective weight loss, which are activity, behaviors, and nutrition, of course. And they're not enough for most people, but you got to focus on those as well.
Great advice. We're going to pivot to yet another topic. Dr. Knight, there was a study looking at pharma representatives who visit physicians in their offices. You know, they bring lunches or they bring breakfast or something along those lines. And researchers from the National Bureau of Economic Research examined the impact of these relationships on the prescribing of a physician-administered cancer drugs in Medicare. And they found that prescribing of the associated cancer drug increased 4% in the 12 months after one of these lunches or events was done, with the increase beginning sharply in the month after payment and fading out within a year. Now, while payments result in greater expenditure on cancer drugs, there are no associated improvements necessarily in patient mortality. It's an interesting study. It wasn't published in the typical journals. It was out of a government research analysis. What's your thought on this?
Yeah, it's a good question. And yeah, I mean, a good point altogether to bring up. And really, I mean, to anyone, is it really that surprising? I mean,
right,
you get kickbacks and you accommodate them and the hand that's feeding you, right? But literally, I guess, in some cases. I think it's good, though, to recognize that there are biases in everywhere and every level of the healthcare industry, not only from physician prescriptions, but even at certain levels of research too. We try to mitigate that as much as we can with, you know, peer review, all of those things. But, you know, so my thoughts are, yes, it's good to recognize. Yes, it's good to try to use any way we can to reduce these biases. So we get to the actual science and we get to the what are the most important things at hand, which is maintaining good health. And it is, you know, kind of it's the prerogative of the physician to recognize, too, that they might be influenced by external factors, too. And we do some training for this in medical school, learning about different types of thinking and heuristics that, that could be damaging to our patients, you know, anchoring biases and so forth. It's a problem that needs to be recognized.
I want to also be fairness to pharma. You know, cancer mortality has improved often from these new drugs. Just as one last point, do you think there's an acceptable balance somewhere?
Well, yeah, for sure. And that's the flip side to it is we can't, I mean, I know big pharma gets such a bad name in so many cases, but we can't discount the great innovation and progress we've had over the years. I mean, you know, COVID vaccine for one, it was developed by our pharmaceutical partners. So there is certainly a balance. And I think with time in these studies and we have academics that are looking into these that we'll be able to arrive at that balance, you know, sooner than later.
Up next, our experts answer your questions. And we'll be right back.
Did I get a postcard? Woo! Mr. Postman.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It? Our producer, Stacey Bennett, joins us now with questions for our experts from our listeners. Hi, Stacey.
Hey, Dr. Joe. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to have you here. Start us off. What's the first question?
Well, our first question comes from Maria in Indianapolis, and she asks, my overweight mother is undergoing surgery. How do you create a safe anesthesia plan for patients with conditions like obesity? Do you have to vary the anesthetic?
Dr. Bowden, I know this is right up your alley. I've never thought about this question, but how does that work?
That's a great question. I'm really, really glad that Maria asked it. And I will start with indicating that the best way to make sure you have a safe anesthesia plan for anybody is to make sure that you have an anesthesiologist, a physician anesthesiologist in charge of the care, working with either a nurse anesthetist or an anesthesia assistant and working with proceduralists, of course. Since obesity is now very, very common and hitting about 43% of our population here in the U.S., it's a problem we deal with every day. So it's kind of second nature at this point. For patients with really severe obesity, it becomes a much bigger issue, and we have to start with making sure we're taking care of people in the right setting. So if someone has severe obesity, they might not be a great candidate for either an office-based type procedure or maybe even an ambulatory surgery center where they're maybe a little bit less equipment or less access to higher levels of care if there is a complication, because there are some potential increased complications with people with severe obesity. So if you're going to a hospital that's accustomed to taking care of folks with severe obesity, which is most hospitals now, there may be specific equipment that both the hospital as well as the anesthesia team may use that might accommodate folks with higher weights. In particular, for anesthesiologists, things that we really have to think about are airway management, putting in breathing tubes or not putting in breathing tubes. That becomes a little bit more complicated in conditions of obesity, as well as what's frequently associated with that, which is obstructive sleep apnea. And that's a problem we deal with almost every day. We do vary doses of medications based on weights and also excess adipose tissue or excess fat. We have to take into account not only obstructive sleep apnea, but other coexisting medical conditions that come up with obesity, for instance, cardiovascular disease or liver disease, kidney disease, things like that do come up with obesity and coexist. My advice to anyone who has a concern about having anesthesia with obesity is make sure that you have someone who's experienced and a physician leading the team taking care of the anesthesia.
I love that answer because it just taught me this is fairly complex. Stacy, what else do we have?
Sarah in San Clemente asks, could you shed light on how Ehlers-Danlos syndrome impacts daily activities and the best strategies to manage it?
Oh, wow. I wish I was San Clemente. That's another gorgeous part of the United States. Dr. Knight, this is definitely in your rubric. Can you answer Sarah's question?
Of course, I'll be glad to. Yeah, it's my day in and day out what we do every day, and I'm glad you asked because patients do encounter a lot of obstacles through their day to day, and the really troubling part too is that most often these patients kind of are gaslighted in some ways that they think that something is wrong and they recognize that something is wrong, and then they're kind of, it's just the tone of the discussion is shifted elsewhere. Let's talk about stress reducing activities or just try to meditate a little bit more, and while those things may be helpful, it misses the point. The most common day-to-day obstacles that patients encounter, it's actually similar back to when we're talking about the POTS, and it could be a result of the deconditioning. And whereas POTS, it might be deconditioning a result of the exercise intolerance, fatigue, and in EDS and hypermobility disorders, it could result from the joint pain that patients suffer from.
I appreciate that. That's a good answer there. Stacy, what else do we have?
This comes from Phoenix. Jayla asks, what steps are being taken to prevent common infectious diseases in children today?
Chad, that is such a huge, broad question. Do you think you could try to tackle that? I imagine this has to do, especially as we find ourselves with all these bugs we just started talking about at the beginning. What are the big steps being taken now?
Yeah, so I'd like to remind everyone, the number one thing you can do to protect kids from infectious diseases is get them vaccinated. So as we know from this show and other popular media news outlets, the United States is going through a big anti-vaccine wave right now that started during COVID, and I think it's continued on, and now we're seeing the effects of that with other preventable diseases such as measles and whooping cough. We're now hearing about measles outbreaks continually in different states due to sometimes travelers, sometimes unvaccinated children who live here. And so we have these vaccines that most of them have been researched and put into practice decades ago to show that they're safe and effective, and they're being not used by people. So first and foremost, I think, is making sure we can get the right education, the right communication out to people, and in fact, do the right policies across the United States to ensure that kids are being vaccinated appropriately, so we're not causing harm by not using a preventative action tool. Second to that, I think, is education. Continually talking to the American public through different venues, this being one of them, to tell people that, listen, the threat of infectious diseases is real, but there's common sense and easy steps that we can all take to make sure that our kids stay safe, starting with vaccinations, starting with teaching our kids from an early age how to wash their hands with soap and water or even just, hand sanitizer, and then continuing that education through their schooling. If they certainly go to school to learn about biology and chemistry and all these other things, unfortunately, the world we live in now, post-pandemic, we have a lot more risks and a lot more threats. And so that public health and epidemiology and infectious disease sort of topical areas should be taught to kids probably at a much earlier age. But that's a long-term education and policy wish of mine. But certainly vaccines work. They are effective. And if we do that, that's going to be the best thing we can do to keep our kids healthy.
Makes perfect sense. Stacy, what other questions?
Sophia in Miami is wondering, what precautions are necessary when administering anesthesia to patients with fibromyalgia?
Dr. Bowden, we've got a lot of anesthesia questions today. This is another one I've never thought about, but how does fibromyalgia impact anesthesia decisions?
That's a really great question. There are a lot of good anesthesia questions, and it's kind of a black box to a lot of people. So I'm really glad to have the opportunity to answer some questions about it. And I am certainly not a fibromyalgia expert, but what I do know about it is that pain is probably the most common complaint that most people with fibromyalgia have, and they're being treated for it. There may be some changes or hints that may be changes in central neurotransmitter processing, meaning kind of the chemical transmitters that are working in the central nervous system, changing that can change things with anesthesia. And most notably, changes in opioid receptors, which is the receptors that respond to narcotic type drugs that we might use around surgery. So we have to make some alterations based on knowing that those receptors may be less responsive to those types of drugs. Depression and anxiety are pretty common among patients with fibromyalgia, and they may be on medications for those. And those may change anesthesia a little bit. There's also a hint that there may be some autonomic dysfunction, kind of similar to the Pott's disease that Dr. Knight was talking about a little earlier, where the autonomic nervous system may not function quite normally. And there's a theoretical risk of cardiovascular problems during anesthesia related to that. But fortunately, there was a big study done about 2 years ago and did not find any significant risk under anesthesia based on that autonomic dysfunction. No, there was no increase in cardiovascular complications under anesthesia. So the main things that we would be watching out for is what medications are patients with fibromyalgia on and how might that alter their responses to medications we're going to use during anesthesia. Do we need to use some alternatives to opioid anesthesia? And that's a very common trend right now anyway, is to try to keep from giving using a lot of opioid for anyone, but especially for somebody who might not respond well to opioids.
Got it. Thank you. Stacy, what else do we have?
Another fibromyalgia question. Jared in Tucson wants to know, what are the latest findings in fibromyalgia research and what treatments are on the horizon?
Dr. Knight, can you help Jared out in Tucson?
I'll do my best.
Okay.
The condition of fibromyalgia is a very difficult one altogether, as Jared might have recognized. But and to add on what Dr. Bowden is saying, yeah, so medications is one big area of research. There was a study that just came out a few years ago looking at a meta-analysis of lots of different trials with medications and see and how they worked over a period of time for patients with fibromyalgia. Unfortunately, it more or less showed that there's not great medications for long-term, for extended duration of improvement with fibromyalgia. But we know that there's also lots of other treatments too, beyond just medications, that can be useful in fibromyalgia. So that's another important area of research. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy is something that we use regularly in our fibromyalgia program with very good outcomes too. The best part being is that there are not the side effects of medications. And so they may have more a longer lasting benefit if it's done correctly now too. So you want to make sure that you have a program that's run by an experienced pain psychologist to achieve those outcomes.
Stacey, what else do we have?
This comes from Jason in Providence, who's taking his dream trip to Scotland in June. He's taking his 70-year-old parents, and his question involves his dad. He says, my dad has a history of pneumonia. What if he gets sick abroad? How do you handle that? Do they call the embassy?
Chad, this is actually a fascinating question. I'm so jealous of Jason because I want to go on that Scottish trip too. But what do you do if you get sick abroad with like something like pneumonia? What's the approach?
Yeah, so first and foremost, again, before making that kind of a trip, make sure that you're prepared to pack all necessary medications and prescriptions that the person might have, and also get any relevant vaccines or sort of pre-travel drugs that might be needed. Now, when you get there, if you do get sick and you are an American without dual citizenship or something of that nature overseas, you should call the nearest U.S. consulate and embassy. So I believe in Scotland, it's in Edinburgh. And so what that is good for is they can actually tell you what medical or hospital facilities to go to that will either take your insurance or have some kind of contractor deal set up to treat Americans overseas. So part of what the U.S. embassies do is they work with local healthcare organizations and certainly the governments of where they are to try and ensure that Americans can get emergency healthcare there without being slapped with massive international healthcare bills. So call the U.S. embassy. If you have time, obviously, if you don't, you'll have to go immediately to an emergency room at one of the local hospitals, but then your next call should be the embassy.
Appreciate that, Stacy.
Missy in Destin, Florida asks, I am 2 months postpartum and I've gained 40 pounds. Is there evidence to suggest a genetic component to obesity? Can I lose this weight?
Dr. Bowden, how do you manage postpartum weight gain? Is it? I think Missy's question is so fascinating because it's common, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about it.
You're not a woman.
Fair enough.
So, of course, women gain weight during pregnancy. That's normal. It's healthy to gain a certain amount of weight. And it's normal to hang on to it for quite some time. 2 months is a pretty short period of time postpartum to expect to have lost all the weight gained during pregnancy. Many women lose about 50% of the weight that they have gained during pregnancy within the first couple of months, but it may take up to a year or sometimes longer. You know, pregnancy is a huge physiologic change for your body, a lot of hormonal changes, and those take some time after delivery to right themselves, and all of those can contribute to weight gain. And certainly, now you've got a newborn, you're not sleeping well. The deteriorated sleep quality really does impact how the body hangs on to weight, stress response to lack of sleep, stress response to having a newborn, and just healing. Breastfeeding, you know, there's indication that breastfeeding can help decrease weight during the postpartum period. Many, many women will tell you that is not true. It certainly was not true for me. While I was breastfeeding, I felt like my hunger levels were very high and I needed to keep eating lots of calories to maintain breastfeeding conditions, if you will. And I lost weight more easily once I stopped. So I would recommend that Missy be patient with herself for one thing and give herself some grace that it takes some time to get off this weight. It took her 9 months to put it on, assuming this is pregnancy weight. It's going to take some time to come off. But the things that you have to pay attention to are the same thing you have to pay attention to with any weight gain or any attempts at weight loss, which is making sure that you're eating lots of protein. That helps make you full and it helps you maintain muscle mass, cutting back on processed foods and simple carbohydrates, which spike insulin and contribute a lot of empty calories to your diet. Easier said than done, especially when you're experiencing the hunger cravings that go with pregnancy and then subsequently the postpartum period. It's not easy for sure. Getting some regular exercise and doing everything you can to normalize your sleep, which is all but impossible for most new mothers.
Stacy, we have time for one last question.
All right. This one comes from Chicago, a woman who recently lost her husband, and we're very sorry for your loss. She says that her husband and she used to look up each other's medical records on their patient portal with formal permission. What happens to your portal when you pass away? Can your relatives still access it? She wants to review the notes.
Dr. Knight, this is our last question. This is actually, I'm completely fascinated by it. I'm sorry for the widow losing her husband, but what does happen to your portal on death?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's a couple of ways of looking at it. So one, I think the big message for listeners here is that, you know, recognize that this can be an issue. You may not see it coming, but you may want to have access to relatives, you know, health information after they pass. So the best thing you can do to that end is, you know, have someone work through with you on getting, you know, your rights put in place, your will, your power of attorney, all those things. So that will save you a lot of trouble after the fact. So you have the discussion with family members, and you know what they want, you know how you can serve them and facilitate anything that could be helpful to them in the future. There are some allowances now in laws that if it is a, you know, like a blood relative, that can be affected, medically speaking, by a condition that someone they're related to, then they will have access to those records if it can affect their treatment, by law. But if it's something like a spouse, in these cases, so easier said to just make sure it's in place before they're passed. But if not, then this can come down to some differences at the state law level. But essentially what it will go to is it will go to like next of kin, who's the closest relationship, and they would have, if the law allows, they would have access to those medical records. So you can check with, maybe there's a social worker or case manager that was helping you in your healthcare to check those state laws and see if you will have continued access, because the records are still there. But as they are protected for living individuals, they are also protected for the deceased.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank the three of you for, again, an amazing job in so many different topics. Thank you, Dr. Sarah Bowden. She's a practicing anesthesiologist and obesity board-certified obesity physician. As always, we love your thoughts. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great questions.
Oh, we loved having you. We had Dr. Dacre Knight, and practicing internist, Ehlers-Danlos Clinic Director. Dr. Knight, we love always having you around.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shervin. So glad to be here. A lot of great discussion.
Absolutely. Last but not least, Chad Nielsen. He is Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Nemours Children's Health in Florida. Chad, so good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Next week's program is a look at two difficult conditions, the latest in diabetes, plus what's new in stroke. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X at JServin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.